Hi, Tim.
Hi Megan, how are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you doing?
I am doing well. I'm here in Los Angeles and I miss DC, where I lived until about a month ago. And I wanted to talk to you about a blog post you just wrote about the goings on in Shaw, one of the better DC neighborhoods, I think.
I'm a fan, but I live close to it, so I would be. I might be a little biased.
So, what is going on there? Tell us about this. It's liquor
Okay,
related,
so
which is great.
there is a tavern. The thing about these neighborhoods in DC is these rapidly gentrifying neighborhoods is that there aren't a lot of services like restaurants. Even there's sort of adequate dry cleaning, but they're missing things like grocery stores. They're really missing restaurants and bars, in part because a restaurant that operates above the level of serving like fried things and carbohydrates needs to sell liquor in order to make their margins. It's very hard for them to compete with a restaurant that sells liquor because the markup on liquor is so much higher. People won't pay the prices for food to compensate for not having liquor, and often they won't come at all. And so it's quite difficult to get a license in this area. To serve liquor in part because DC has an extremely complicated and powerful licensing regime, and in part because the local community objects, in part for the sort of traditional reasons that local communities do object to having bars near them, which is that they cause disorder. And it also often becomes a proxy for gentrification, and so there's a sort of if you can keep the bars out, then the gentrifiers won't come. I think that's not really very, I mean, it might slow the pace a little bit, but the main pressure is just from the small size of DC's housing stock, not from any like proximity to bars kind of vibe. At any rate, against this background in the Shaw neighborhood, which is about a 10, 15-minute walk from where I live over in Eckington, there was a tavern that was opening in the location of an old record shop, and people have been watching this tavern under construction for
It's like the
like
only
a
tavern in
long.
that area, right? It's like the only
Yeah,
restaurant
it's
now.
basically the nearest place you could go would be this was on 6th and Florida. About a 4-block, maybe like a 10-minute walk away, there were some restaurants. And so if you happen to live right there, it's actually not that bad. The problem is that for people who live further east, that was the only thing that was walkable. It's about a 20-minute to half-hour walk to the nearest bar, other than a place that's just really a bar and serves a little bit of wood-fired pizza. But it's about a half-hour walk to the nearest kind of sit-down restaurant with fine dining, full menu kind of place. And so people were very eager to have this come because there's so few places in the kind of Shaw, LaDroite, Bloomingdale, Eckington neighborhood that serve sit-down food with alcohol. And when it finally opened, I actually went there opening night and they weren't serving any alcohol. And it turned out there had been some sort of a problem with their license. It later emerged that what they had done, DC requires you to, even if you're hosting a kind of private event, you have to get what's called a one-day liquor license. And this runs $300 if you get it. But when I was planning a wedding, we'd actually looked into this. And basically, the caterers made it clear that you would have a very difficult time with them if you didn't go through them. And they marked up the license to $500 to $700. And so effectively it makes it impossible to cater your own events, to or at least do the booze for your own events, which is also where the caterers make most of their markup. And so it has this special one-day liquor license, which is a great way of protecting business for caterers. And they didn't get one. And furthermore, in order to get the alcohol, it seems that there is some debate over who, allegedly a former manager, forged the paperwork necessary to procure the alcohol from the distributors.
Now, is that
So
still alleged?
the
Has anyone actually proven that yet? The forgery
I
part?
don't you know it, no. I know that the manager was fired. I don't think the owner is disputing it. So it seems, I
Tricky.
guess, close to proven, but I haven't seen any sort of direct evidence of this. All I've seen is a bunch of people saying it happened.
Well,
And
just
I
to fast
haven't.
forward, so they obtained liquor without a proper license for these
Yes.
like previous events, and then when they opened the alcohol,
But
it's
they
the
didn't sell that
ABV.
alcohol. These were private events that donated the money to charity. It wasn't that they sold alcohol to anyone.
Okay.
They just obtained the alcohol and then gave it away, basically, as far as I can tell. I could be wrong about that, but that is what seems to have happened, is that they illegally obtained alcohol and then gave it to people for free.
And has put them in peril.
Which has basically caused the alcoholic beveraging regulatory administration, I believe is the name, ABRA for short, to hold up their liquor license. So they opened and they were supposed to get in a week, and then it dragged on. And long story short, last Saturday they just closed their doors. And unfortunately, that's basically it for the tavern. So the libertarians and some progressives, Jamelle Bouie, for example, has joined me in my outrage about this. Not because I'm okay with people forging paperwork, but because the rule for which they forge paperwork is anti-competitive crap. It's basically put there to protect other people from either to protect other people from competition, or it also functions as sort of backdoor zoning. Right. If you can't get someone out with the zoning, you go to the liquor control board. And if you can't go through the liquor control board, you go through someone else. If you want to have a zoning code, have a zoning code. Don't try to set up quasi other regulations that you can use when the zoning code fails you, which is basically what this is. It's a way for insiders to kind of protect what they want their neighborhood to be like against outsiders who might come in and change it. And so it's also cost people jobs, the chef and the servers. I think there's about 30 of them are now out of jobs. There's no tavern there. And it sent a regulatory signal to other people who want to come in. Yeah, it's bad for the economy, but it sends a signal about opening a business in our neighborhood. So this has just generally been true, that the liquor board has slowed. It takes, I think, about a year to get a liquor license. This is my sort of informal survey. I could be wrong about that. But you need a lot of capital to do that. You know, Big Bear Cafe, which is a coffee shop, did it by being a coffee shop first. And even then, they got a huge amount of hassle. But in general, you not only need the capital to refinish a place and stock up and hire people, you then need the capital to wait until the liquor board control board decides to give you a license. And so it ups the cost of being a business. And in this case, I think makes it less likely that other people are going to follow, which is just bad for everyone.
So the question that I have is, like, what is the constituency for opposing this rule in D.C. or anywhere? Because I think this sort of, you know, liquor license regime is common in a lot of cities where you have, you know, restrictions that are anti-competitive and it protects the existing businesses who are, you know, often the people with the most political clout. You know, how do you get the city to change this? I mean, who's that, like, group of people who can mobilize around it? And, you know, what does the system look like when it's not so anti-competitive? I mean, is there any reason, do you think, to have regulation of liquor sales like that?
I really don't. I think that the arguments that people offer are, well, you can use these licenses to crack down on other things that are illegal, but it seems to me that you should use the existing laws that we have to crack down on those things. It's illegal to sell. First of all, we have a business licensing regime as well. So, for example, if a bar sold alcohol, like routinely sold alcohol to people who were clearly minors and not just someone with a fake ID, someone who really looked old. I used to get served all the time because I'm really tall. And that makes people think you're old. And so it was really that no one ever carded me until, like, I turned 30 and moved to D.C., where they card everyone. But in general, like, if someone does something like that, where it's clear that they're deliberately serving minors, where it's clear, then we have a business licensing regime that already exists that you could pull and just deny them and operate. You can also fine them because this is a criminal offense. You can send cops around to run them up. So those kinds of offenses, noise violations, again, you can. There are ways to handle that through the police, through zoning, through the business licenses. And so these liquor control boards, as far as I can tell, there are two things. They're a legacy of prohibition. So a lot of states.
So we should just hate them automatically already.
Well, I do anyway. Right? But and second of all, that they became captured by two really strong constituency groups. They became captured by the neighbors, and they became captured by the people who already have licenses, right? Who obviously then love strong licensing because it shuts down competition. And those groups, the thing is, right, that a lot of people who are outraged now and who want Shaw's to exist, once the neighborhood is about where they want it, they will want to use that power in order to shut down new entrants that might change the character of the neighborhood in some way. They might turn it into Adams Morgan or might And so the support, except for people, I think Jamal.
Yeah, I just want to touch on just briefly the idea that it might turn into Adams Morgan, because people from D.C. won't get this. But Adams Morgan is like the nightlife strip in D.C. where it's just like 2,000 drunk fraternity brothers right. puking everywhere and eating jumbo slice. And there's this sense that if you opened up like another place, if you allowed bars into another place, you could suddenly wind up with a street where it's all bars, which seems like it would be difficult or take a lot of time. But doesn't that suggest that it would just spread out so there would be less Adams Morgan going on anywhere? I don't know.
I have two things. I think that's part of it. But also, I mean, they do cluster, but no one says, oh, my God, it might turn into H Street, right? Which is another district that is basically wall-to-wall bars.
And pie.
And they're like some kind of restaurant. And they're restaurants, too. But they're like, it's basically the same thing as Adams Morgan. It's a bunch of bars and a bunch of restaurants where people go on weekend nights to go. And no one thinks that's bad because that's where a different group of people hang out. I think I will. They're less fratty, more hipsterish. I think it's fair to say. I mean, the delineation, certainly. Yes. So no one's horrified by the notion of turning into H Street, but the neighbors will. Eastern Market's doing this. It's another neighborhood in D.C. It's around a historical market, and so it's sort of she now. And you see people trying to shut down development there. So the problem is there's no constituency for getting rid of the rule. There's mostly only a constituency for getting control of the levers that allow you to operate the rule. And I think there are some people like me and Jamel and Matt Iglesias, but we're crazy. We're ideological, you know, we're ideologues who have this thing about, got this very consistent, carefully planned out ideology that we talk about on the internet. But for most people, that's not really how they think about these problems.
Well,
so no, I don't think there is a constituency for repealing this. But, you know, people don't – the consistency is really costly. Inconsistency is very costly for me and Jamel and Matt, so it's a lot easier to be consistent for us, right? But for most people, that kind of constituency where you allow your neighborhood to turn into – you know, you're a homeowner, especially and as someone who bought a house in the last year. The temptation to think about things differently once you buy a house is really strong. The temptation to be like, oh, well, of course I was in favor of social service organizations opening up places, but not near my house. And, you know, what used to be NIMBYism is now just community activism like that. And because for me, I'm sure inconsistency is very costly. It's easy for me to kind of resist that. But for most people, they change their minds when they have kind of different, because that's, for most people, they don't have to have a publicly consistent ideology or an internally consistent thing that's like a very vital part of what they do every day in their lives.
Well, it's not so much, you know, consistency. It's how do you convince them that it's actually in their best interest to let their neighborhoods change and to let new things open up and old things close. I mean, in a lot of these neighborhoods, this is a lot of, like, boarded up storefronts. There's a lot of not just, like, residential, but just nothing going on. And, you know, it's hard to see how your property value wouldn't rise if you had a couple of functioning businesses on your street
Here's the thing, though, is that I'm in the weird position of being the libertarian who is not taking the side exactly because I'm one of the gentrifiers, but who is sort of defending this to many of my much more progressive neighbors. And here's the thing, especially for the people who are objecting to the wave of white gentrification and white affluent gentrification that's moving into these neighborhoods. If you're poor, you have very little except social capital, right? What you have is the network of people that you know who you can rely on when something goes wrong. They are your daycare network. They do the things for you that more affluent people paper over with money. If you disrupt that, you know, it's not that they want boarded up windows, it's not they want crime, et cetera, but it's basically destroying their most valuable asset, and a lot of the people in our neighborhood aren't homeowners. So it's great if you are a landlord who doesn't live here, who rents, and some of our landlords do live here, I don't want to say, but, you know, a lot of people are basically renting properties that are owned by absentee landlords. If you come in and disrupt that, you've just cost them. Right, because they're going to go somewhere where they don't have that same network. They don't have it. It just blows up their main social asset, and it doesn't really give them much because they're not going to be around for very long to enjoy the amenities. So, of course, there are lots of homeowners here, and they benefit either from having the amenities or selling at a higher price. But there's also a lot of people here who aren't homeowners, who don't appreciate having their lives disrupted. And I understand why. If it were me, I would be enraged, right? I would think, these rich people have everything, and now they have to take the only thing I had. And they've got to have that, too. So, I do understand what the objection is, right? And similarly, if you live in Eastern Market, you like living in Eastern Market. You don't want to live in Adams Morgan, and you don't want someone to come along and turn Eastern Market into Adams Morgan. I think for a lot of reasons that that's not a realistic approach to kind of urbanism, philosophy, et cetera. But I totally understand why people feel that way.
Well,
and
okay.
why
so,
they,
so now,
they act
this, this
to
is interesting.
Block
so you see where they're coming from, and you can make a sort of compelling argument while, around like why people would want this sort of no change regime still
yeah.
around. And if you can see both sides of that, like is there some middle ground to be found, or is it just really that's life and that's where we're at?
I think ultimately, in some ways, there's no middle ground on gentrification just because the pressure in D.C. is so weird. And so large. And I think partly it's federal government spending, but I don't think that's all it. I think it's after the DC riots in 1968, after Martin Luther King's assassination, the perception of crime in the city increased much more than even the crime did. But mm-hmm. as that happened, middle-class people moved out, including black middle-class people, which is why one of the things that happens in my neighborhood, which is basically like a black middle-class neighborhood that's gentrifying now, one of the big, and I'm sure you remember this from DC, one of the big tensions in DC between gentrifiers and the existing people who live in the neighborhoods is that on Sundays, huge influxes of people from Maryland come and park, double park, they block alleys, they block driveways, et cetera, to attend church in the neighborhoods that they left 20 years ago. And so, lots of people left, and as that happened and the relative mix of poor people and wealthy people changed, crime spiked, and then property values plummeted, which just, it created a vicious cycle until D.C. bottomed out with a very high crime rate and a very low income rate, and then it started to climb back up. And as that's happening, crime's falling. And as the crime falls, that's attracting more people, and I think that's actually the main dynamic. I don't think it's as much federal spending as people think it is. I think that's some of it. So I don't think there's a compromise, because the fact is that the people
maybe it's housing policy.
More income.
Maybe it's
and it's not necessarily a race thing. I mean, there's lots of people, lots of black middle class people buying expensive houses in these neighborhoods, but it's definitely changing the character of the neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, I will. I have not yet learned the relevant zoning regulations of my new city, but I will report back once I figure out how easy it is to open up a bar. So
meanwhile,
things are happening at a more macro level. It's not just bars in D.C. that are making the economy run. I wanted to get your sense of Alan Krueger, who was the Treasury's top economist for the first 2 years of the Obama administration. Now he's going to be the chair of the Council of Economic Advisers. My main question is, does it even matter whether there are economic policy advisors in the White House? Is this an environment where anything that he says will have any impact? But also, what do you think of him? He's a man who's done a lot of varied and interesting research as an academic, too.
Well, as I wrote yesterday, I mean, you and I have both been, I believe, in off-the-record briefings with Alan Krueger, and I don't think anyone's going to get mad at us for telling tales out of school if I say that I think he came off as incredibly impressive with just this incredibly deep knowledge of what was going on in the economy, of labor market economics. Generally, he just when he gave you answers, they were kind of subtle, and they showed you a side of something you hadn't thought about it before, and I don't know if that was your impression, but that's certainly been my impression of seeing him in action.
Well,
so I'm impressed with him as a guy.
The thing about Alan, which always impressed me, was when he was at Treasury, what he always used to do for a long time at least, was every time there was a jobs report, the first Friday of every month, I think is how it goes, he would do like a briefing for anyone, any reporter who wanted to come at the Treasury. And so, you know, these are jobs reports that were never particularly good because we really haven't had a really excellent jobs report in the last couple of years. I mean, sometimes you'd see some rise and like, I think there was maybe 2 months where you're like, oh my God, maybe the recovery is going to come. But in general, it would be going up, but never enough to like even correct for population changes. So this was the guy who had to like, try and spin these really crappy numbers for the administration every Friday. Not try and spin them. That's not true because he's not really like a political type, but he was the messenger on this. And it always struck me, one, was that he was always very realistic about it, and two, just like the fact that he had to think about it every month, more so than maybe a lot of other policymakers in the administration, I always thought was impressive. And you're right, he is a good public speaker, he's good on TV, and that may be a lot of his role, unfortunately.
I think it does matter, though, on the margin. I mean, I agree with you. I think everyone at this point agrees, right? There's not going to be any major, unless something radical turns around and Obama regains a pretty sizable majority in the House and Senate in 2012, as well as winning re-election. There's not going to be any huge new initiatives that the administration's basically done all of the major policy making it's going to do, barring a war or some other weird catastrophe that we can't predict now. I mean, do you think that's fair? Actually, I should say, I'm putting words in your mouth.
You know, here's what I think. I mean, I think A, you're right. Certainly in the near term, I think through 2012, we're not going to see like some kind of big thing unless there's something at the super committee. Now, I'm not going to write off the super committee immediately. And just for the record, I hate the fact that we're calling it the super committee. It drives me nuts. But, you know, maybe
something. It sounds to me like it's
about.
Like going to be in charge of getting us the Olympics in 2020 or.
They probably have more chance of getting us the Olympics than of fixing the budget. But outside of that realm, no, nothing's going to happen. I mean, I don't think there's any stimulus. I mean, maybe they'll do the trade deals, but those have already baked into the cake. I don't think so. I think post-2012 election, assuming that Obama wins, even if, you know, he doesn't win majorities in both houses, which seems unlikely, you know, one of the things until recently in my budget reporting in Washington that the veterans of the Clinton era would always tell me is that in 1996, when they reelected Clinton and they reelected all the Republicans in Congress, it seemed to sort of like cement in the leadership's minds that, yes, voters have divided government in mind. And sort of led them to just like deal with that and start making some of the deals that happened in 1996 and 1997. So maybe, you know, 2012 just ratifies that in voters' minds and they decide to work together. Now, I think that's sort of unlikely because it's just so much more toxic now than it has ever been before. But I am an optimist, so maybe that's the path forward. I don't know.
It's hard for me. I mean, I assume that it is, in fact, more toxic. Everyone tells me that. But, of course, in 1996, I was really mostly busy with my first job. I wasn't paying a huge amount of attention to politics. So I assume it was more, that it's actually much worse now. I assume
my benchmark is like Norm Ornstein. Like, Norm Ornstein is like, you know, this AEI congressional expert who's been in D.C. for
right.
decades. And he's like, you know, he's who you imagine when you imagine like a centrist. And he's saying like, this is the worst thing I've ever seen in my lifetime. So like, I feel like, you know, and there are other dudes in that genre, like the sort of centrist been around here for a long time, not inclined to be like, I don't know. It seems to me, and you know, I was a child in 1996. It seems to me that things are worse, but they may have the possibility of getting better. Of course, the big economic policy sea change will be if Obama doesn't win, obviously, and that's a story that Alan Kroeger won't write. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's curious. You know, people have been saying that he's such a like a micro-focused labor economist. He's done a lot of research on, say, how like individual people are affected by unemployment insurance or how minimum wage affects firm hiring, things like that. You know, just to connect back to our last conversation, you know, this regulatory issue on like the municipal level has united progressives like Matt and Jamal with libertarians like you. You know, is there some kind of micro level stuff that, you know, Kroeger could Kruger, I really should know how to pronounce his name, can propose
Kruger,
and maybe,
I'm sure, but
Kruger, maybe
now
Republicans
that
will get behind. Nah, that's crazy. Republicans aren't going to pass anything. See,
well, it's hard to think what it would be that they would have kind of the authority to do. I mean, I've proposed that we should basically offer a rebate of the payroll tax of 1 month for every month that the person you hire was unemployed, which would at least kind of distribute the unemployment more evenly and prevent this human capital depreciation. But I'm not sure that that's and sort of aid the what economists call the sticky wage problem of people not wanting to accept a lower pay rate. It would help them, right, because the employer could pay them a little more and still save a little money on hiring them versus someone else.
And that was the finding in Kruger's last research, too.
But I think that, you know, I think it matters on the margin, right? Like, it's good you've got a labor economist in the office when you're thinking about policy. And because the administration's still doing things that matter on the margin, right? Treasury, the way they handle regulation, there's all sorts of things that they're still thinking about, even if they're not making major policy initiatives. And as a libertarian, I'm probably more skeptical of major policy initiatives anyway. So I'm not, you know, I think it can't hurt to have him, but I don't know how much it's going to help. But then I also am not sure that there's how much the administration could really do, because I do think there's a limit on how much we can borrow and spend. And the fact that we have very low interest rates now does not, to me, necessarily imply kind of an unlimited appetite for Treasury bonds. It implies a sort of limited appetite that's coming up against a limit. But if you sort of expand the number, it doesn't necessarily mean that enough people come into the market and take all of the extra Treasury bonds. It may mean that the price falls catastrophically. That's neither here nor there, however. I'm not sure how much we could do even if Obama still had Congress. I mean, I think that there really are hard policy limits. And the administration, when I talk to them about things like stimulus, they seem actually quite sincere. You don't know. They could just be rationalizing the fact that they can't do anything, right? But they actually seem quite sincere in saying that, look, there's a cost to this stuff, too. And that cost is that there's a big future over debt overhang and that there's declining returns to stimulus over time and that we don't think it's necessarily a good idea. Now, maybe they're just putting the best face on things. You obviously never know until, you know, all the books are written 10 years from now. But, I mean, what would you have them do? What would you like to see Kruger working on?
I mean, in a perfect world, I would do what every economist thinks that we should do, which is, you know, a jolt of stimulus combined with a credible long-term deficit reduction plan, with healthcare reform expanding on Obamacare, and we would, do amazing amounts of housing policy to, you know, refinance folks and deal with, the debt overhang, the great contraction theory of the recession. I mean, look, if I was the king, which some people seem to think Obama is, and he's just not doing these things out of casual ineptitude at work. You know, I'm also certainly in the Matt Iglesias camp of thinking that, you know, the Fed could do a lot in terms of inflating away our debt. It's also a camp with Kenneth Rogoff, who said, look, we need 6% inflation to deal with this debt overhang. But, what interested me actually, you know, with the Fed, you know, seeming like maybe the last independent place for economic policy right now, was David Leonhardt's New York Times article a few days ago, talking about how the debate within the Fed was much more narrowly constrained, than the debate around the country. And I was curious. I don't think I read whatever you wrote after the last Fed meeting. I mean, what do you think of the three dissenters and the sort of the limited discussion of the open monetary?
I think the Fed has two interesting problems. So the first part of the Fed's problem, there's a great Woody Allen quote that I always use with stuff like this, which is talking about the role of bankers and financial reform, which obviously makes a lot of people nervous, which is, he says, you know, I think my brain's my most important organ, but then look who's telling me that. And I think that that's actually like a real problem with regulation, especially something that's really complicated like financial markets, which is that bankers have to play a big role in it because they're the ones who know what's happening in the market. But they're naturally not necessarily venally. Just because, in the same way that we all, like journalists or, you know, you talk about First Amendment to journalists, and I've never met a journalist who thinks that there should be any restrictions on free speech. And like, I believe this too, and I believe this deeply, but it also benefits me, right? So there's always going to be these... the problem is that we tend to believe things that benefit us. That's how we ended up in the position where they benefit us, right? And so the Fed is, the way it's constructed, it has a lot of its input comes from the regional Fed banks that are mostly basically selected by bankers.
Yes.
And those guys don't want inflation because inflation is bad for banks. And it's not that they think, I need to do this to pay off the people who appointed me. It's that the people, they appoint people who feel the way that bankers do, that inflation is this terribly dangerous, horrifying thing. So it's part of the problem.
Yes.
And you're already seeing this.
And the fact that there's like a lot of evidence that that's not true, though, is an issue. I mean, I don't dispute the mechanism you're suggesting here. I think that's right. And I don't think it's corruption. I think they're just wrong and looking out for their own interests. But, you know,
it's not even that. I don't even think they know they're looking out for their interests. If you're a banker, you feel like inflation is like the worst thing, right? You're just in a culture where you feel like inflation is the worst thing that ever happened.
I mean, sure, whatever. I mean, I think it's semantics ultimately. But my point is, I mean, are you in favor of that system where private banks have such influence over the regional feds and thus over the FOMC? I mean, it seems like you need to divorce them from policymaking to do what a lot of at least some economists think is one of the right things to do. What Ben Bernanke thought was the right thing to do in 2002.
It's really tricky because this is, I wrote about this the other day. There's a kind
Just specifically though on monetary policy, not on bank regulation, which I think definitely requires maybe more banker participation, but just on monetary policy alone.
The banks create the money ultimately. If they clamp down on credit, the money doesn't get created. It doesn't matter how much you pump into the system, right? Money ultimately gets created when bank balance sheets inflate and that money gets lent out. That's how the mechanism works. And so having a central bank that's basically like at war with the banking system, it's never happened. They tend to be fairly aligned with
interest.
Somehow I
think the Fed would win that one.
Yeah, but they won in Zimbabwe, right? So it's, you know, I'm not suggesting that we're talking about that kind of inflation.
I'm just saying
like you can win, but it might be a Pyrrhic victory. Right? Like, you know, you can keep pumping money into their balance sheets all you want, but if all they do in response is just hoard the money, which is what we have seen periodically, right, in these things.
Well, I'm not just talking about quantitative easing. I mean, I'm talking about the Fed setting actual interest rate targets, you know, have worked in the past and basically being willing to...
But it only works because people understand that that means that the Fed's going to pump enough money into the system to hit that interest rate. But if the money's not going anywhere, which is essentially what you've seen in Japan in various interludes, and also what we've seen...
But Japan never really tried to do what people are suggesting. I mean, that was Bernanke's whole point in his papers in the early 2000s.
Yeah, yes, you can drop it from a helicopter. It's true. We could helicopter huge wads of currency, but it's very difficult. Our system doesn't work on currency, which means that actual direct currency things, possible, very tricky. It's very hard. What I'm saying is it's really hard to do this stuff unless the banks are kind of on board. Right?
Yes.
It's very
hard to survive the next 4 to 5 years of our financial system without any growth in the economy.
But it doesn't work that way, right? Like, this is kind of, I wrote about this a couple days ago, is this idea that you can just kind of lay down the law to the people you regulate and that all you need is an independent regulator who's really going to
But it's not a regulatory
lay down
question.
The law.
This is monetary policy. We're not talking about...
Monetary policy is a regulatory.
Rules are setting deposit, you know, standards.
Still
or
a regulatory issue. I mean, like, controlling the supply, the Department of the Interior controlling the supply of land in the West, that's a regulatory issue. The Federal Reserve controlling the supply of money is a regulatory issue. They're regulating the supply of money.
There are many, the history is replete with examples, even conceding that, of people who did not want to be regulated, being regulated, and it working. I mean, it's the same thing the financial sector has said every time anything has been proposed, you know, from before the FDIC even, and largely they've been wrong.
I'm arguing that regulating them without their cooperation is actually a lot harder than it sounds, which is why regulatory capture is a thing, right? This is why regulatory agencies basically inevitably get captured by the people they regulate, because it's very, very hard to regulate anyone without their cooperation. In the same way, it's very, you get CEOs who say, well, I'm going to go in there, I'm going to kick some ass, I'm going to change everything, right? And I'm going to fire anyone who doesn't do what I say. And it turns out that's really difficult to do. In fact, it almost never works. And it doesn't work because if you don't have buy-in, there's a zillion ways they can make sure that what you want to do doesn't happen. You can't control everyone. There's too many of them. And that's fundamentally...
Yes. Are they all acting in concert? Are they now a cartel opposing the economic
interests
of the
United
States?
No, it's not a cartel. I mean, it's like city government. You know, why...
Well,
why,
I think you're overestimating the challenges here and then a little too quick to throw up your hands in the face of what, you know, is I don't know. Did you see Christine Lagarde's speech at the...
I have heard many CEOs say that you're overestimating the challenges and that I'm really going to go in there and it's going to be different. And it's not different. They go
luckily,
in there.
The real world is not just
change.
Based on what CEOs say they do. I mean, this is...
I'm saying...
These are not like
pie
in the sky theories that have never been tried before. These are not things without empirical backing. I mean, this is...
Well,
you know,
actually, as far as I know, it's... A successful
and like
central
saying,
bank without,
oh, it's really hard. Like it's going to be really hard to do it. Is not like a response. I mean, that doesn't make it impossible. That doesn't make it unlikely. There are people in the financial industry who do buy into that idea, who have argued for this.
As far as I know, the backing.
It's a little too easy to just be like, well, you know, you need to get their buy-in. I mean, we've certainly tried to get the banks buy-in, and I think the last 3 years have shown how well that's worked, as they've made massive profits and still can't recover.
I think we're now
for a different strategy.
I think we're now into a sort of different territory on Dodd-Frank or whatever. But again, Dodd-Frank, I think some of the stuff's not going to happen the way that you expect because of exactly this, right? They're going to subvert it. That's what people
well,
do.
Well, yeah, but I think again, you know, I started off talking about monetary policy. I don't think Dodd-Frank is necessarily a part and parcel with that. I mean, I realize you want to insist that monetary policy is regulation, the two are one and the same, but I think the dynamics are a little bit different.
Well, regulation is the administrative state, right? Regulation is when you're regulating the money supply. It's not the same as the EPA, but the Department of Interior.
I think it's important then to recognize the differences between monetary regulation, which we can call it, and you know supervisory safety and soundness regulation. I think there are different dynamics and trends in those two areas, and to pretend that they're different, to pretend that they're the same would probably be a mistake.
I'm saying that I am not aware of any example of a successful central bank which didn't have buy-in from the banking system. I mean, I'm not aware that any central bank has just gone out there and been like, I don't care what you guys think. This is what I'm doing. We're getting hyperinflation. We're going to get 6% inflation. That's exactly what we're going to get. They may be out there. But most of the central banks that I'm familiar with that operate in stable, you know, advanced economies, as far as I know, they're basically very, very tight with the banking industry, and they tend to reflect the concerns of the banking industry because that's where the information that they use comes from. And that's kind of an inherent problem of regulation, that the information that you get comes from the industry that you're regulating, and there's no way to get around that, right? They're the people who have the information. You can mandate that they give it to you, you can do it, but you're always going to be getting the information that they give you, and it's always going to come through their kind of lens. And so, yes, you could have a tougher, you could have more inflation. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that it's actually quite, you know, you can't just say we're going to have a Fed that isn't, that just...
Sure you can. Alan Greenspan ignored bankers all the time. So have many other Fed chairs in history when bankers have called for higher or lower rates and they've ignored them. Look at Jean-Claude Trichet. It's very common for bankers to criticize what a central banker does.
But that's not the same as – that's not exactly what we're talking about now. My understanding was that
basically we're not going to agree on assuming that all regulation policy is the same. So leaving that aside, I'm curious, did you see Christine Lagarde's speech at Jackson Hole?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
Okay. Well, she gave the speech. The new head of the IMF gave this speech basically saying – you know, we have these global imbalances right now, and we are really at a moment of crisis where growth is slowing, where things are about to get really, really bad. And it's sort of this sense that I'm getting from a lot of other people. Michael Pettis, who blogs at China Financial Markets, is a finance professor in China. And he laid out a series of like, I think, 7 or 10 predictions for the next 10 years. That is actually really fascinating. I recommend everybody read it. But one of the things that he basically says is he sort of divides things into three. He says, like, China is going to have much lower growth very soon, but they are going to weather that. They're going to be able to rebalance and avoid political unrest. That Europe is basically screwed, and that the U.S. is going to become increasingly protectionist to protect its own growth. And it sort of paints a picture of an economic system that in, like, the last decade, you know, we have sort of all said, you know, globalization, free trade, you know, this is going to work. And now it seems like people who know this stuff and see what's happening are sort of throwing up their hands and saying this system is moving inexorably towards something really bad if we can't do anything about it. And I'm curious, you know, just now on like a global scale, you know, do you think that people can fix these problems at all? You know, what do you see happening on a big level? Just to close this out with some really terrifying stuff.
I think that fixing the problems in Europe involves a heroic leap of trust that I am not really sure that the people in the central countries are prepared to make with countries like Greece, right? It basically, something like a Eurobond involves believing that when Greece is going to never violate free ride on the credit of the central nations, right? Germany guaranteeing Greece's debts implies a really high level of trust in the Greek government, and that's just manifestly not there. I think Matt Iglesias wrote this morning, and he's right, right? You basically have two groups of people looking at this problem. You have people looking at it and saying, there's no way to get out of the euro, and the only way to save the euro is a eurobond, and therefore a eurobond has to happen. And then there's another group of people who are looking at it and saying, there's no way to save the euro except with a eurobond, and the eurobond can't happen, so therefore exit is going to happen. And I tend to be in that group. But they're both really, you know, it's an impossible conundrum. And I think that, yes, like, bad things are going to happen in Europe. I used to report on places like Argentina and various African countries that would have crises. And you would be watching these crises, and you know what has to happen, right? There's no kind of way around it. Although, to be fair, Argentina then found a third way of, like, nationalizing its private accounts and sort of gradually siphoning funds out of the banking system and so forth. But you know what policy response has to happen to fix the crisis. It's completely obvious. And you sit there and you say, why can't they do it? It's really obvious what has to happen. Any economist will tell you virtually the same thing. And they can't do it. And I used to wonder why that was, and now I don't. They can't do it because no one lives in a dictatorship. Even dictators don't live in the dictatorships that we imagine unless they're like North Korea. And even then, their control is not as absolute. They have constituencies they need to buy off. And the government of Argentina could not tell its citizens, we are going to take money from you and cut services and ship it to creditors abroad because that means that we could borrow more money in the future. It's just, there's no way. It wasn't going to happen. The default was inevitable. And so, and similarly with, you know, various other things that they did, there was no point at which the government of Argentina was going to make nice with creditors, even though that was, in my opinion, stupid and has shut them off from the credit markets for the last 10 years almost. And it has not done them well in the end. I mean, they've had to do things literally like nationalizing the equivalent of 401ks and taking all the money in them because they can't get any money any other way. They run a deficit. But politically, they had to play hardball with the creditors, even though it hurt them later. And politically, Germany's not going to bail out Greece. Whether it's rational, whether it's in their best interest, they don't trust the Greeks that much. That's what. And so I think, yeah, there's lots of things that you can say we should do. We should make a credible deficit reduction agreement in the United States, and we should trade that with stimulus now. But we can't. A credible commitment to cut the deficit because we haven't managed to do it in the past. There's no way to make that. Even if everyone came together and agreed to do it, there's no way to make it. No, we haven't done it in the past. We've done it for very temporary
budget authorities in the 1990 budget deal worked.
The commitment, yeah, but the commitment that we need is not a commitment for 8 years. It's a commitment for 30. We can't,
you know,
promise.
If you could make it 8, you might be able to make it 16. I mean,
but we didn't even make it 8. I mean, the stock market
bubble. We absolutely did. The CBO is authoritative and definitive on this, that the budget controls in the 1990 deal worked. Absent,
yes,
of course,
but,
the Gulf War, price spending.
They're also authoritative and definitive on the fact that had we not had the internet bubble, we never would have closed. We never would have run a surplus. And if we hadn't been racking up Social Security surpluses that committed us to future Social Security payments, so over a long budget horizon, weren't surpluses. They were just commitments for money spent later. Had we not
yes,
had those,
and,
we would
and,
never
and,
run
but what does that have to do with the fact that, you know, you had a place in 2000 where you had surpluses? Policies could have been made to continue that. Like, the fact of the matter is, you know, if you can do something for a number of years, it changes.
If we wanted to continue the surplus, we would have had to cut taxes. We would have had to raise taxes and cut spending in the middle of a recession.
But not continue the surplus, but have responsible fiscal policy. I mean, so basically your position is that now it's not only that we can't have a short-term deal, even though we have in the past, but we can't have a long-term deal because things happen in the future. I mean, so there's just no hope for anyone. I mean, should everybody just go home? Despite the fact that it is empirically possible to have good fiscal policy for periods of a decade?
You can't bind future Congresses. There's no way to do it. You can kind of do it, but
yes,
Congress
everybody knows that
it.
Who knows the legislative process, but again, that doesn't mean you can't have, you know, successful fiscal policy. I think, frankly, a problem with Congress and with a lot of political reporting is that people set their expectations far too low. We so easily throw up our hands when Congress fails and say, well, you know, it's never been done before, but it has.
I think it means that the signal that you send by spending a whole bunch of money right now and saying we're going to not spend money later, given fairly limp historical record of the not spending money later part, is that we're going to spend a whole bunch of money right now. I don't think that you send a big signal on the deficit reduction side just because... And especially after, I mean, I think the Republicans can congratulate themselves for this. I think especially after the theatrics that we just went through, that really damaged perceptions that we were going to, I think going off of the 1990s budget deals, people have been kind of assuming we were going to get our acts together and grow up. And now I think they're kind of assuming we won't. So I think that I don't think there is necessarily a way to send a credible signal on
I don't care about a credible signal. A credible signal is not an issue here. An issue here is dollars and cents and getting the math working.
What's the point of making
it? It doesn't matter what the
but
signal
then why
is.
Would you,
if they make legislation,
if you don't care about the
signal,
then why would you tie stimulus now to deficit reduction later?
Why would you tie stimulus now to deficit reduction later? Because the economy desperately needs demand.
Okay, no, but why would you? Why wouldn't you just do the stimulus? Why would you do anything about deficit reduction later? Which I mean,
we
all agree.
Are you asking
most
me why deficit
think...
reduction is important? Because we're on an unsustainable path with healthcare spending. I mean, it's totally possible to hold two separate ideas in your head at the same time, that we're suffering a demand crisis in the near term and that over the next 30 years we need to do something about healthcare spending and reduce the structural deficit and raise taxes. All those things are very compatible over time. And worrying about what decisions you make now will send what signals to the market is less important than making good policy decisions going forward. And if you establish a government track record of doing that, the signals will take care of themselves. But the issue is not just that we, you know, are worried about what other people are saying. The issue is that we just aren't expecting good policies from anyone. You know, it's just we're throwing up our hands. And it's not an impossible task, you know, and I'm not worried about, you know, near-term inflation or interest rates. You know, I've been hearing people for the last 3 years tell me that inflation in, you know, Zambia or Zimbabwe is around the corner. It's just not if people make the right decisions.
I'm not really worried about inflation so much, although, I mean, I think people underestimate the extent to which Bernanke himself, the Fed, the institutional culture of the Fed is that it took them a long time and it was really painful to recover from the inflation of the 70s and to get their inflation-fighting credibility back after the incalculable damage done by Arthur Burns, mostly, although some of the people under Carter weren't so good either.
And they did a very good job of that. But if they get stuck in the idea that credibility for credibility's sake is what their mission is, then they're totally wrong. They have a very specific mission that's supposed to react to changing conditions in the world and the market. It's not just to maintain their credibility over time.
Sure, but it took a long time.
I mean, I recognize that there is an institutional and cultural obstacle to that, but it is wrong and misguided and dangerous.
It took over a decade, and it required 20% interest rates and 11% unemployment. It wasn't painless, and it was in a different
economy. I am very familiar with the recession that Paul Volcker had to impose to deal with inflation, but we have had inflation and go trending towards deflation for the past 20 years. The circumstances are different.
I agree, but the circumstances were, I mean, we got inflation after we'd had deflation trending toward, you know, inflation, low inflation trending towards deflation in the 20s and 30s. And then we got a burst of inflation. And then I'm not necessarily defending them, although I think I have.
It sounds like you are.
I think more humility about the fact. I generally assume.
I think more humility about the fact that there's 9.2% unemployment in this country and that we're not growing and we're not in a very good position is really what's necessary on the part of these policymakers.
Well, the tendency of regulators and policymakers in general, right, is always to over-respond to the current threat and under-respond to future threats. And that's
not what we've seen in the last 5 years. If anything, right, we've seen the opposite.
The Fed sees its role as to be more forward-looking, and its credibility with markets.
And yet every single time the Fed has made a prediction, has issued a statement in the past 2 years, they have wildly overestimated the recovery and been inaccurate on the other side. I mean, I understand you're saying this is what the Fed thinks, this is how the Fed sees, but that does not make them right, and it does not make them responsible.
I think that I'm sure that they're making errors because people make errors.
I am too.
I am less sure that I am smarter than a whole bunch of really smart monetary economists about monetary policy. I'm also...
There are a lot of really smart monetary economists who think they should be doing more. Rogoff, Scott Sumner, Bernanke, 2002. I mean, it's not. I don't understand why we should sacrifice ourselves
not exactly
on the altar of the Fed's credibility.
You know, he was chief economist of the IMF. But I agree. I agree. There are smart economists who disagree. I'm not siding with either side. I'm just more sort of less confident of my ability to be 100% sure that the Fed is wrong and that the other people are right.
I'm not 100% sure that the other people are right or that the Fed is wrong, but I am 100% sure that the Fed is not making things better right now and that the near-term problem is more pressing and more important and more critical than anything that's going to happen 5 years down the line.
But that's, again, like I'm less sure of that. I don't know what's going to happen 5 years down the line, so it's hard for me to say that it's 100% true that the Fed, that those problems will be better. So I am more skeptical of the ability of regulators to just make things happen by being kind of like...
You know, I'm not talking about, you know, snapping my fingers
and
I'm a
also
magic
more
wand
skeptical.
Here. These are, you know, established tools. And I'm not, like, naive about the idea that, you know, Ben Bernanke is any more of a king than Barack Obama is. But the fact is they are not doing things that they could do. That's the basic fact. They are not doing
that's true.
Things
and
that they
I,
could
I
do,
think that
things that
I would
people
like
think
to see
might work,
more aggressive.
Things that have been done in the past. And I think
would
that's
like
what
to
bothers
see us
people. I think that's why people don't have a lot of trust in American institutions anymore, because they see a lot of people throwing up their hands and not doing anything.
Well, sometimes there's nothing to be done, right? The existence of a problem doesn't necessarily imply the existence of a solution. And so it may be that there isn't anything they can do without making it worse. But I just think that, to me... when I look at this, I would like to see us inflate more, right? Like, I would like to see, I supported QE3. I would like to see more monetary stimulus. I would like to see more done because, I mean, I think one of the problems is this, what people say is the Fed moves last. In other words, that it doesn't do you any good to, you know, sort of step on the fiscal stimulus if the Fed just then sucks that extra stimulus out of the economy, which I don't really think they did during the stimulus phase. But I would like to see them do more monetary stimulus. I think we agree on that. I'm just not angry at them and convinced that it's because they're morons or because they don't care about the American people or they're not, or they're just really, really stupid and they don't understand what needs to be done.
I think you've already given a good narrative for why they're not doing what they do. They come from a culture and an institution that's locked in a set of policy problems that are 30 years old. I mean, I don't think I'm implying that they're, you know, malicious or malevolent. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. They're out of touch.
Well, but I think that in general, that's what, again, this is what regulatory agencies do, right? The FDA is solving, is still like really, really intensely the way that it handles drug approvals is really, really intensely inflected by thalidomide. The FDA held up thalidomide not because they suspected anything about it, as far as I can tell, but because the paperwork just didn't clear. And then it turned out it caused horrible birth defects. And that has really, really changed the... I mean, they're incredibly risk-averse when it comes to drug approvals, except for things that basically treat terminal diseases, like cancer and AIDS, where they've opened up a lot more. And
the wonderful thing is maybe they're right about that. I don't know anything really about the FDA, but I can tell you that's an entirely different thing than what we're talking about.
It's the same thing in that, like, traumatic incidents in regulatory history stay with... shapes the way that the
I hear you. I hear you.
Forever.
I hear you. Absolutely. You're right about that. But I'm saying they're wrong about letting it shape them. I mean, I agree with you. The phenomenon exists. I'm just questioning whether it's a good thing or not. And with that, I got to go eat some lunch. Any final words?
No, it's been a good talk. Pleasure to speak with you. I hope you're settling into LA. What do you miss about DC? I should get your
friends.
Final thoughts on
I miss
that.
All my friends.
Not the
I
food.
Miss my friends and,
you're in,
and
like,
the Florida
food
Avenue.
Paradise
grill.
Now.
No, the food in LA is way better. Sorry, DC.
I'm really intense. Every time I go out there, it's just it's painful to come back to DC with our sad supermarket tomatoes and lame avocados. But it's good talking to you, and I'm sure we'll chat at some point in the future. And meanwhile, good luck in your new gig and your new location.
Thanks, Megan. Take it easy.
Cheers. Farewell, Internet.